Okay, so let's see what the translation is here. By His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation. I'll read it and then we can read it together. Then, in the beginning of Kali Yuga, the Lord will appear as Lord Buddha, the son of Anjana, in the province of Gaya, just for the purpose of deluding those who are envious of the faithful theist. Purport by His Divine Grace. This is a 2.5-page purport, so bear with me here. It's a lot of stuff in this purport which we're going to go over. It's a, what I call an action-packed purport. So let's see where it goes. Purport. Lord Buddha, a powerful incarnation of the personality of Godhead, appeared in the province of Gaya, Bihar, as the son of Anjana, and he preached his own conception of nonviolence and depreciated even the animal sacrifices in the Vedas. At the time when Lord Buddha appeared, the people in general were atheistic and preferred animal flesh to anything else. On the plea of Vedic sacrifice, even every place was practically turned into a slaughterhouse, and animal killing was indulged in unrestrictedly. Lord Buddha preached nonviolence, taking pity on the poor animals. He preached that he did not believe in the tenets of the Vedas and stressed the adverse psychological effects incurred by animal killing. Less intelligent men of the age of Kali, who have no faith in God, followed his principle, and for the time being they were trained in moral discipline and nonviolence, the preliminary steps for proceeding further on the path of Godhead or God realization. He deluded the atheists because such atheists who followed these principles did not believe in God, but they kept their absolute faith in Lord Buddha, who himself was an incarnation of God. Thus, the faithless people were made to believe in God in the form of Lord Buddha. That was the mercy of Lord Buddha. He made the faithless faithful to him. Killing of animals before the advent of Lord Buddha was the most prominent feature of the society. People claim that these were Vedic sacrifices, when the Vedas are not accepted through the authoritative disciplic succession. The casual readers of the Vedas are misled by the flowery language of this system of knowledge. In the Bhagavad Gita, a comment has been made on such foolish scholars, avipaschitya, the foolish scholars of Vedic literature who do not care to realize the transcendental message through the transcendental realized sources of disciplic succession, are sure to be bewildered. To them, the ritual ceremonies are considered to be all in all. They have no depth of knowledge. According to the Bhagavad Gita 15.15, Vedaischa Saviraham Eva Vedya, the whole system of Vedas is to lead one gradually to the path of the Supreme Lord. The whole theme of Vedic literature is to know the Supreme Lord, the individual soul, the cosmic situation, and the relation between all these items. When the relation is known, the relative function begins. And as a result of such a function, the ultimate goal of life, or going back to Godhead, takes place in the easiest manner. Unfortunately, unauthorized scholars of the Vedas become captivated by the purificatory ceremonies only. The natural progress is thereby checked. To such bewildered persons of atheistic propensity, Lord Buddha is the emblem of theism. He therefore first of all wanted to check the habit of killing, of animal killing. The animal killers are dangerous elements on the path going back to Godhead. There are two types of animal killers. The soul is sometimes called an animal or the living being. Therefore, both the slaughter of animals and those who have lost their identity of soul are animal killers. Maharaj Parikshit said that only the animal killer cannot relish the transcendental message of the Supreme Lord. Therefore, if people are to be educated on to the path of Godhead, they must be taught first and foremost to stop the process of animal killing. And above mentioned, it is nonsensical to say that animal killing has nothing to do with spiritual realization. By this dangerous theory, many so-called sannyasis have sprung up by the grace of Kali Yuga, who preach animal killing under the garb of the Vedas. The subject matter has already been discussed in the conversation between Lord Chaitanya and Malunachan Kazi Shaib. The animal sacrifice, as stated in the Vedas, is different from the unrestricted animal killing in the slaughterhouse. Because the Asuras, or the so-called scholars of Vedic literatures, put forward the evidence of animal killing in the Vedas, Lord Buddha superficially denied the authority of the Vedas. This rejection of the Vedas by Lord Buddha was adopted in order to save people from the vice of animal killing, as well as to save the poor animals from the slaughtering process of their big brothers, who clamor for universal brotherhood, peace, justice, and equality, and equity. There is no justice when there is animal killing. Lord Buddha wanted to stop it completely, and therefore his cult of ahimsa was propagated not only in India but outside the country. Technically, Lord Buddha's philosophy is called atheism because there is no acceptance of the Supreme Lord and because that system of philosophy denied the authorities of the Veda. But that is an act of camouflage by the Lord. Lord Buddha is the incarnation of Godhead. As such, he is the original propounder of Vedic knowledge. He therefore cannot reject Vedic philosophy, but he rejected it outwardly because the Sura Dvisha, or the demons who are always envious of the devotees of Godhead, try to support cow killing or animal killing from the pages of the Vedas, and this is now being done by the modernized sannyasis. Lord Buddha had to reject the authority of the Vedas altogether. This is simply technical, and had it not been done, so he would not have been so accepted as the incarnation of Godhead. Nor would he have been worshipped in the transcendental songs of the poet Jayadev, who is a Vaishnav Acharya. Lord Buddha preached the preliminary principles of the Vedas in a manner suitable for the time being, and so also did Shankaracharya, to establish the authority of the Vedas. Therefore, both Lord Buddha and Acharya Shankara paved the path of atheism. And Vaishnava Acharyas, specifically Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, led the people on the path towards a realization of going back to Godhead. We are glad that people are taking interest in the nonviolent movement of Lord Buddha. But will they take the matter very seriously and close the animal slaughterhouses altogether? If not, there is no meaning to the ahimsa cult. Srimad Bhagavatam was composed just prior to the beginning of the age of Kali, about 5,000 years ago. And Lord Buddha appeared about 2,600 years ago. Therefore, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Lord Buddha is foretold. Such is the authority of this clear scripture. There are many such prophecies, and they are being fulfilled one after another. They will indicate the positive standing of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is without trace of mistake, illusion, cheating, and imperfection, which are the four flaws of all conditioned souls. The liberated souls are above these flaws. Therefore, they can see and foretell things which are to take place on distant future dates. Tatakalau sapavritte samohaya suradvishtyam buddho namnak jana sutta kikateshu bhavishyati. Then in the beginning of Kali Yuga, the Lord will appear as Lord Buddha, the son of Anjana in the province of Gaya, just for the purpose of deluding those who are envious of the fateful deists. So first of all, I'd like to thank Shruti Dharma and all the devotees here at Bhaktivedanta Manor for giving me an opportunity to speak. I haven't been here since 1982, so it's really nice to come back and see how much development and how much the temple has grown, and hopefully I might be able to share something this morning to inspire you all to keep making it grow more. And I think it's also important to point out, because of the nature of this verse, like I said, this is an action-packed verse, and where I happen to live in California It is only got a voter population of 5,000 people in the Ojai, city of Ojai, which is just north of Los Angeles by a little bit. A little more than that in the whole valley, but it is, I sometimes jokingly refer to as New Varanasi, because it has every kind of impersonalist philosophy there. Teacher, yogi, meditators, you name it. It's really phenomenal how such a tiny little town has attracted so many different twisted types of philosophies, and how many people are out there listening to this stuff. I won't mention any names, but if anybody you can think of, I can almost guarantee you there's some remnant or some person holding fort for that particular faith there. So preaching for us is very, very difficult. Frequently we find ourselves having to kind of like, you know, find people, maybe kind of hang outside some of these gatherings they have and look for the ones who maybe haven't completely fallen into the well of impersonalism. Lord Chaitanya says in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Prabhupada translates the verse, the appropriate verse there, saying that anybody who has heard the impersonal philosophy of Shankaracharya, Prabhupada uses the word doomed. He says their spiritual life is doomed. He doesn't mince his words. And we have seen that. We have personally seen that. There's been a few occasions where we've attended, you know, again, it's very hard to preach. We're trying to find usually the people that are already down in the bottom of the well. There's nothing you can do. They when you talk to them, they say, oh, you're just an illusion. You know, actually, we're two human beings here. We're having a conversation. No, that's all an illusion. There's so many different flavors of what they come up with. But the ones who are kind of circling around the well, they haven't quite jumped in yet, you might be able to find them and actually reason with them a little bit and help them understand before they take the dive that you don't need to settle for some of these very twisted ideas. So just to give you a sense, and Prabhupada actually points this out towards the end of this purport here. I'll tie it together in a second. Just to give you a sense of how ridiculous some of this can get. One of the things that I find is sometimes helpful, if people are really genuinely, honestly serious about wanting to look at or searching for some legitimate spiritual path. And I have to say for myself, when I first met the devotees, they pointed this thing out that Prabhupada is reflecting on towards the end here. He says, this Bhagavatam is without trace of making mistakes, illusion, cheating, or the imperfection, the imperfect senses. These are the four human flaws. I'm sure we're all familiar with them. And I know when I first heard this with the devotees, I went home. I was in college at the time, and I thought I was a smart guy. I went home and I said, "Well, I don't have to accept this Krishna consciousness." And then I kept dwelling on these four flaws, and I kept on coming back to, "Nope, you know, I make mistakes. I have a propensity to cheat. I fall under illusions, and my senses aren't perfect." And I just couldn't get away from it. And that had a big part of me finally saying, "I got to surrender. I've just got to surrender." So sometimes when we're given a chance, we went to one particular gathering, and the way this particular gathering went was they asked everybody, it's open to the public, anybody can go. It's not like these are all the hard sell people. They want to, you know, try to share what they have with the public. So we're public, so we went. And first thing they do is they go around the circle, they ask everybody to make sort of an opening statement. Because I was very familiar with their philosophy, that was the first thing I said. And I said, what I'm here to find out is how anybody can actually be sure about anything when it's being generated from one's own mind or from somebody else's mind that you're accepting because of these four flaws: imperfection, propensity to make mistakes, propensity to cheat, and imperfect senses. And I said it very clearly, and there was about 30 or 40 people in the room. And it was really phenomenal because then, of course, everybody went around. They all introduced themselves, made their comment about why they were there and what they were listening for and their little spin on what reality is, which is sometimes very bizarre. Then they opened it up for dialogue, for conversation. And I thought it was interesting that very few people even heard what I said. They were so preoccupied with saying what they wanted to say. Very few people actually even stopped to consider how really important this question is. How can you figure anything out for yourself? Which, by the way, in the whole New Age world, we're teaching exactly the opposite of what they're all preaching, which is it's all within you. You don't need any books. You don't need any philosophy. You don't need any. You sit and meditate and it'll be realized and that's the end. Which, of course, is very empowering because then that means you can do whatever you want. But so they were doing all their different things. And but there were one or two people who actually heard it. And you could see it was eating away at them. And they were coming up with all these different ways of trying to, like, well, what about this? What about that? What about this? So, of course, you know, it wasn't too easy to expose how, no, you're still relying on yourself, you know, your own, you know, cognitive reasoning process. But anyhow, the part that was extremely interesting was, so this conversation went on, this dialogue went on for about an hour. And then they asked everybody to go around and summarize. Jai Jai Shri Ratko Kulananda Jai Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman. So then they asked everybody, just as they had asked everybody for an opening statement, they asked everybody for a closing statement. And again, it was very interesting. Most people were so caught up in their own ideas that, you know, it was just more of the same. And of course, when I got a chance to speak, I said, I find it very interesting that the whole purpose of this meeting is for everybody to explore their own spiritual growth and how they understand anything. And, you know, what is it that you believe is the purpose of life? I mean, there's many ways you could characterize what was going on there. But nobody actually really even began to address this very important point, which I think is the starting point of everything. If you're relying on yourself, then how can you be confident in anything because of these four human flaws? And I said it like I'm saying it now, very, very passionately to, you know, like try to break through whatever it was that was keeping people from hearing it. And again, you know, it kind of went around a circle, but the one or two people who actually heard it, this one lady, you could see for the whole hour, she was just, ah. And at one point, she was so confused, she said, you know, just to show how the mind works, she was saying things like, well, what is a mistake anyway? Because a lot of these New Age philosophies, there is no such thing as a mistake, because whatever we would maybe refer to as a mistake would be just another step towards growing and learning, which there's a thread of truth in that, but it becomes a big evasion for the higher truth here. So at one point she just blurted out, I said, what's a mistake anyway? And I said, well, you know, if you put the cake in the oven and you burn it, that's a mistake. And, you know, that had a little resonance, and they, oh, okay. So towards the end, this individual, you could just see it was just tearing her up, and she couldn't, you know, they get attached to these pseudo-philosophies, and they couldn't, she couldn't give it up. So finally, what her closing statement was, and she said it very infectious, she said, I know I don't make any mistakes. And I just, and, you know, of course, I was giving her the eye, like, okay. And then she said, because I don't exist. So it's just see how just the mind, how it can be so distorted. So anyhow, I didn't want to really, I only have a few more minutes. This purport gives a lot of information. And one of the things that I've observed, and Prabhupada, even back when he was writing these books, has observed it also, is that I think there's several places where he says the churches are becoming empty. I think even in Europe, this is more true in America. I mean, the Christians are constantly trying to, you know, do some research, but as, you know, the concepts of science are becoming more and more prominent in the schools and stuff, and people are really, you know, they want answers. They don't want some soft sell, so sentimental, you know, half-baked theology. And because they're not, let's just be frank about the fact that for the, in terms of the United States, the majority of the people are following Christianity. There is Judaism and there's a couple other things that are going on. But for the most part, they're following some flavor of Christianity. And so as they are not getting the answers there, they're going other places. And where they tend to go is to either just hardcore atheism. A lot of people are just starting to, and there's a whole now wave of people that are just taking up atheism. But many of them are not quite ready to go that far. They still have some sense that there must be more meaning to life than just, it's just chemicals, and you're here now and you're gone and that's it, poof, you know, back to vapor. So they're taking up Buddhism. A lot of people are taking up Buddhism. And the reason why they're taking up Buddhism is because Buddhism is, for, and I should say Neo-Buddhism, or another one that's really popular is Neo-Advaita. There is a philosophy in the non-dual tradition, and we actually acknowledge that. Of course, Prabhupada makes it very, very clear that that tradition went out of style in Satyayuga, you know, several hundred thousand years ago. It's certainly not something we can do in Kali Yuga. But because there is something there, and there's, you know, the Vedas talk about how the process is very strict. You just have to completely flush out all the thoughts, any sense gratification, completely focus on the third eye. And then, of course, you know, after going through all that trouble, then if you're lucky, you get to be in the Brahma Jyoti until you realize, and I sometimes say this facetiously to the people I deal with in OHI, I say, well, if you're so interested in just vibrating with energy and white light, why don't you just go into a closet and stare at a light bulb? Because that's essentially what they're doing. And of course, they look at me like, huh? And it's like, well, no. I mean, that's what it's like being in the Brahma Jyoti. How much fun is that? It's not going to be very satisfying. And therefore, Prabhupada says, eventually, the soul wants exchange. Everything happens in relationship, not in isolating yourself. In fact, the psychologists would tell you that people who really isolate themselves are usually like really having some serious emotional problems. You know, these are where the nutsy people are. So everything's happening in relationship. So what many people are taking up, and it's a hodgepodge. It's a mix of Buddhism and Neo-Advaita and maybe a little Brahmavadi, but it you know, nobody really understands, and nobody's certainly studying the Vedas like we are. So it just turns into this big sort of conglomerate hodgepodge that kind of ends up with, you can do whatever you want. Because it's just a big illusion at the end anyway. Everybody ends up dead and in the ground. And in the concept of Buddhism, you know, most people have a sense that their goal is nirvana. Nir meaning without. Vana, at least in Sanskrit, means forest. And we know in the fifth canto that there's a whole chapter called the forest of material enjoyment. So they want to get out of the forest of material enjoyment, and they take it all the way to the extreme where nirvana means a place where there is nothing. Absolutely nothing. Therefore, Prabhupada says it's voidism. Of course, they don't really study it as much as we do, so most of us here are very familiar. You're all nodding your head going, yeah, we understand that. But they don't understand that. But what they do understand is when they adopt this philosophy, then it kind of opens the door for whatever you want to do. There is no principles, there is no regulation, there is nothing to strive for. I've even had people, you know, of course, actually I had a learning curve. When I came to OHA, I used to preach to people. And of course, as devotees, we're trained that when you say something, you support it with scripture. And so we all learn a lot of verses and, you know, we quote the verses as we speak. And I started getting these really strange sort of reactions from people. And I eventually it became very apparent that they didn't appreciate it at all. I mean, they can quote Shakespeare and they can quote Einstein and they can quote whoever, the pop rock star, whoever it is. But if you quote Bhagavad Gita, they resent it. They just sort of think you're some sort of religious fanatic. I know you're trying to press me because you know Sanskrit. So you really want to, and then it got to the point where if you try to talk to people, they'll say, oh, you still read books? I'm so sorry to hear that. I mean, I'm not really trying to be offensive here. I'm trying to share with you how extreme it can get. And I'm sure probably some of you have your own stories like this. So in any case, the point is that, you know, Buddhism in itself, and I have all sorts of notes here, I'm probably not going to get a chance to really go through much of this, but Buddhism itself, there are aspects of it that we can appreciate. as you know, there's the four noble truths, and then they have what are referred to as the eight aspects of Buddhism. I'm going to have to see if I can. Let me just see where I am here. So there's referred to the Eightfold Path of Buddhism. I think it'd be worth maybe going over this because what I have discovered is that people who are a little serious about Buddhism, and this is probably more applicable for people in the Asian countries where it's their natural heritage and their tradition, but when it comes across what we refer to as the pond, the Atlantic Ocean or the Pacific Ocean, depending which way you're going, it takes on a whole different flavor. Everybody loves the word Zen because then you can throw whatever you want into it and come up with nothing or come up with rationalizing whatever you want. You know, that whole concept of the cone, you know, these little expressions that really make no sense. What's the sound of one hand clapping? You know, like, huh? And then one day some devotee just immediately said, oh, that's easy. That's what it sounds like. You know, it's like devotees are so practical. But they love these little mind twisters because it helps reinforce the fact that at the end, it doesn't make any difference. It's just all happening in your little mind, okay? So, just to give some acknowledgement here, but the thing is, the people who are actually really seriously trying to grow and find some spiritual path, one thing I admire about those people that are practicing Buddhism is they're actually adopting some austerities, if they're really doing it. Now, a lot of people call themselves Buddhists. I actually encountered somebody in Ojai, and it's a small town, so you see each other over and over again. So you have this ongoing conversation that spreads out over many years, and you kind of pick it up wherever you left off. And I asked this lady, I said, so I observed her at some public function, and she was eating animals. And I said, I thought you were a Buddhist. She said, oh, I am. And I said, yeah, but you're eating chicken or whatever it was. And she said, oh, that has nothing to do with it. You know, and of course, as devotees, we understand, no, wait a minute, that's the whole purpose of Lord Buddha's mission, ahimsa. You understand ahimsa, don't you? And of course, they like to say that, mercy, compassion. Okay, could you kind of like connect the dots for me how it's mercy and compassion when you're killing innocent animals? Of course, at that point, you know, the conversation ends and they go off to some other direction. So the point is that there are some aspects of Buddhism that we can respect. So, for example, but I also want to point out that there's things which obviously we very seriously disagree with. For example, out of these eight aspects of Buddhism, these are the eight laws of Buddhism, you might say, they're all very very nicely presented. The first one, I'll see how far I can get on this. I'll just shoot through them real quick and then we'll share some insights. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Sounds really good, except for when you actually start looking into it a little bit more deeply and you start really understanding what their concept of these things are. So, for example, right view is, the first thing I said was, if you're suffering from the four human flaws, who's going to give you the right view? And keep in mind, there was actually a Tibetan Buddhist who came to Ojai. It was interesting. He packed out an auditorium of about 250 people. I mean, anything Buddhist, it's just bam, it'll be packed. And so when I finally had a chance, he had questions and answers at the end. And I really genuinely wanted to understand, you know, do you have some kind of a collection of scriptures that all the Buddhists would kind of agree upon? Because we do. We have the whole Bhagavatam. We have the whole Vedic, the canon of all the Vedic knowledge. And one of the things I find very frustrating is when you talk to people, they just pull things out of the air, and Buddha said this, and Buddha did that, and blah, 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 blah. They say, well, yeah, well, how do you know that? Is there some record of it? So I figured, okay, here's a guy, he's a high lama from Tibet. He came to Ojai, and I said, well, this is about as high as I think I'm going to get from somebody who's practicing this tradition. And at the risk of embarrassing myself in front of 250 people, I asked the question. I said, do you have some scripture that, first of all, is actually authoritatively represents the teachings of Lord Buddha? Like, we have the Bhagavad Gita. We say Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita. End of discussion. God spoke it himself. Is there anything that Buddha spoke? Is there a scripture? And he said, no, there isn't. And I said, well, then what do you have? And basically what he said is, we have the writings of all the monks who have practiced Buddhism. Which basically means you have basically the realizations of all these people who spent, I think in Tibet, it's not uncommon for them to sit in meditation for 8 hours a day. So we do that with japa. Of course, it's not the same. We're meditating in Krishna's name. So Krishna's there. And that's a whole different thing than sitting there trying to completely obliterate every thought in your head. Which is impossible, by the way. You can't do it. That's why it's an artificial, you know, Prabhupada, I like that part where Prabhupada's, I think he's describing the purport in one of his songs. He says, Krishna consciousness is not an artificial imposition on the mind. Well, guess what? Buddhism is. You've got to give up the ego. You've got to basically drop the ego. You've got to drop desires. Well, okay, I want to have a desire to drop desires. How does that work? You know, there's a lot of philosophical conundrums here. So anyhow, that's the first one, right view. How can you have the right view if you're an imperfect person? And there's no scriptures that telling you what it is. And all you have is all these people sitting there meditating, having all different sorts of realizations, and sometimes there's some consistency, but frequently there isn't. And within that first one are basically the four, I don't know exactly what they refer to them, but the four noble truths, I guess it is. That life, and some of these things we agree with. There's suffering, we all know that. There's suffering. What is the cause of that suffering? And how do you end that suffering? And what is the path for it? So they have good questions. I'm not so convinced they have good answers. Anyhow, I think I'm just looking at the clock. I don't want to disrupt the whole morning program here. But there's so much more that can be said on this subject. We could go through each one of these eight aspects of what Buddhism is. Some of them are very admirable, that we can fully say, yeah, go for it. And some of them have very serious philosophical problems that I think most average devotees would immediately notice it. So anyhow, I think for the sake of time, I will end here, open it up if anybody would like to ask any specific questions.